British Public Radio. Current Affairs.
Social media, free speech and the law. A Chatham House event with Director of Public Prosecutions, Keir Starmer.
As a general proposition, there has always been a healthy tension between free speech and the reach of the criminal law. That's not new just because we've got social media. We've had that for a very, very long time. In this country, traditionally, the balance between free speech and the reach of the criminal law has been held by notions such as place and reaction. So if you look at the Public Order Act from 1936 onwards, you'll see that the balance is struck by saying you can say certain things in private, but you can't necessarily say them in public. And you can say certain things so long as they don't provoke a violent reaction, and you can't say other things if they do, such as the incitement provisions. So they've been the traditional sort of benchmarks for this balancing exercise. More recently, the whole notion of hate crime has added to the mix. But within all that, for decades, there's always been a protected area, somewhere where you can pretty much say and think what you like. The rapid growth in social media, particularly in the last 10 years, to my mind, poses a challenge to that balance for a number of reasons. The first is the sheer scale of use. Some of you may be familiar with some of these figures already, but it's now estimated that there are 1 billion active Facebook users worldwide, of which 33 million are in the UK. As for Twitter, it's estimated there are over 380 million Twitter users worldwide, of which 12 million are in the UK. The average number of tweets a day is thought to be 340 million. I should add that LinkedIn has an estimated 4 million users in the UK, and there are over 800 million visits to YouTube every month. 72 hours of video are uploaded to YouTube every minute. So the scale is quite extraordinary. The extent of the reach is equally extraordinary. Access is ubiquitous and instantaneous. Banter, jokes, and offensive comments are commonplace. And communications intended for a few have the potential to reach millions. And the other reason why social media has posed a challenge to the traditional balance between free speech and the criminal law is the governing legislation. And for this, we have to just take a little step back in history. Back in the early 1930s, telephones were being developed. They'd been tried out in the late 1800s, and various international calls had been made. But by the 30s, telephones were becoming a little bit more common. Certainly not common, but more and more people were beginning to use them. But back then, you could only make a long-distance call if you went through an exchange. They hadn't cracked direct dialing. So you'd have to phone the exchange. The exchange would then make the connection with the number that you wanted to connect to, and that way the call could be put together. And in the 1930s, the exchanges were largely staffed by women. There were about 200 exchanges. And Parliament got very concerned about the prospect that as more people were going to use telephones, these women might be exposed to language that they ought to be protected from. And therefore, in 1935, Parliament passed the Post Office Amendment Act, making it an offence to communicate any message by phone which was, quotes, grossly offensive or of an indecent, obscene or menacing character. Now, in the first draft of the bill that became that act, the only protected category was the staff in the telephone exchange. But that got changed to the public in general. So onto the statute books in 1935 came a provision to protect largely staff in exchanges from, quotes, grossly offensive messages or messages of an indecent, obscene or menacing character. The Act also prohibited communicating any message which was false for the purpose, or if the purpose was for causing annoyance, needless inconvenience or needless anxiety. And I tried to track down where that came from. That was apparently because before telephones were much used, telegrams were the only way of getting a message swiftly to somebody, or reasonably swiftly. And there was a habit, apparently the late 1800s, of mischievous people sending telegrams to people with a false message, such as your relative is dead, seriously. And the family would then have real distress before they could find out for sure what the true situation was. So covering off both of those issues in 1935, Parliament said if it's grossly offensive or if it's false and you're intending to annoy someone, that's an offence. That Act has been reenacted over a number of years. It's expanded in two ways. Firstly, what is prohibited is not just messages, but messages or other matter. And secondly, a message by telephone became a message by public telecommunications systems in 1969, when the telephone systems went onto a different public framework. And in 2003, that became a public electronic communications service. So, by the time we get to 2003, we have a Communications Act, which keeps the original 1935 wording, prohibiting grossly offensive or indecent, obscene, or menacing messages if they are sent by a public electronic communications system. 2004, Facebook is established as a private company in the United States. And 2006, Twitter is established, again as a private company in the United States. Now, you'd have to be a member of Parliament with considerable foresight to have had that in mind when reenacting in 2003 the old 1935 provision relating to messages. And you might be thinking, well, how does an American, private American company have the 1935 Act intended for public telecommunications apply to it? And the answer is, in a case last year of Chambers versus the DPP, often known as the Twitter joke case, the divisional court held that any message that's accessible by the internet in this country has passed through a public electronic communication service, and by that decision extended the 1935 provision that was intended for exchange staff to the millions and billions of people who send messages by social media. And hence, we've got the challenge of balancing free speech and the criminal law in an environment where the scale is enormous, the style or context of communicating is arguably different to other styles and context, and where we're dealing with legislation which was not drafted and drawn up with a view to establishing a balance for social media, coming as it did at least a year before social media began really to take off. And that's led to a number of cases coming up for consideration, and some of these will be familiar to you. Early last year, a man called Liam Stacey was prosecuted for messages that he put out on Twitter about Fabrice Muamba, who was the footballer who, you may recall, suffered a heart attack during a football game on a Sunday afternoon. He was taken to hospital straight from the football ground, and whilst he was there, about 2 or 3 hours later, Liam Stacey started sending a series of extremely offensive messages about Fabrice Muamba and his family. He was prosecuted and he was sentenced to 56 days in prison. Matthew Woods also last year was prosecuted for very offensive comments made on Facebook, this time regarding the missing children April Jones and Madeline McCann. his messages went up within hours of our charging decision in that case. And the significance of that is, you may recall the alleged perpetrator had been arrested, April Jones obviously still missing, and we were acutely conscious of the fact that when we announced a charging decision, we were sending a pretty clear signal to her parents that we no longer thought that April Jones was alive. Up until then, they'd been holding out the hope that she was still alive. So it was a very, very difficult and tense period. And within 2 or 3 hours, Matthew Woods was putting messages which were so grossly offensive that nobody has ever actually repeated them in any public form, as far as I'm aware. But these judgment calls are not easy to make, depending, as they do, on context, circumstance. And in an environment where very strong views are held about whether cases should be prosecuted, what cases should be prosecuted, what are the tolerable limits. And as a result of the increase in the number of these cases, and in recognition of the difficulty in making the judgment calls, I decided earlier last year that we should publish guidelines for prosecutors indicating how they should approach the exercise of deciding whether or not to prosecute. The guidelines, which you may or may not have seen, take prosecutors through the decision-making process in any case involving a communication sent by social media. And the general approach we've taken is this. We've said to prosecutors, the first thing you must do is go through an initial assessment and put the case in its proper category. And the categories that we've drawn up are these. One, cases where the communication constitutes a credible threat or violence to person or property. So credible threat to person or property is category one. Category two are communications which specifically target an individual and which may constitute harassment or a campaign of harassment under the Protection from Harassment Act 1997. The third is communications which may amount to a breach of a court order. And you may have seen that we recently prosecuted a number of individuals for revealing the name of a rape victim in the Ched Evans case. There was a court order saying the victim shouldn't be named. A number of people named the victim using social media, and we prosecuted those people. And then the fourth category is communications which don't fall into categories 1, 2, 3 and which may be considered grossly offensive, indecent, obscene, or false, the old 1935 offence. So the first thing to do is work out, is it a credible threat of violence? Is it targeted harassment? Is it breach of court order? If it's in those categories, then a pretty robust view is taken about the need to prosecute. If, on the other hand, it doesn't fall into those categories and is what might be considered grossly offensive, etc., then the guidelines indicate there should be a high threshold of prosecution and that in many cases a prosecution is unlikely to be in the public interest. And we also worked out through the cases we were seeing that it did make a difference whether you actually were trying to reach the subject matter. The difference really, I suppose, virtually, of going into a cafe or bar and having a good old gossip about someone who isn't there and saying it to their face. And we thought that a distinction could be drawn in that respect. It's quite interesting. Daniel Thomas, who was the footballer who made the remarks about Tom Daley, was genuinely quite shocked that Tom Daley had ever got to know about it. Because he thought he was making an unfunny remark to his mates and family. And when he appreciated, actually got to the intended victim, that came as a surprise to him. And I'll end just by making the slightly broader point, and that is that you may have noticed that since I've been DPP, we've issued many more publicly facing documents in the shape of guidelines about the way that we take decisions. The reason for that is this. If a public authority exercises discretion, as we do, if you exercise that sort of power, it seems to me you should set out in advance how you're going to approach a problem, and you should give your reasons afterwards. That way, people can know the approach you're taking and can hold you to account by looking at your reasons and assessing for themselves whether you've approached it in the way you said you would. And I'm not sure how I could be properly accountable if I didn't operate in that way. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My name is Paul Martin. I'm a member of the Royal Institute, and as well, I'm also a television and filmmaker and reporter. And as such, we come across potential libel quite often. Not only that we may libel people, but sometimes we can be libeled. I wanted to know, in that gap between social media and, say, written print media or television, the internet, do you take a slightly stronger position in relation, say, to libel on the internet of somebody than you would in social media? And if so, where do you draw the line and decide on criminality?
David Ormond, former Permanent Secretary of the Home Office. Could you say a little bit more, and forgive me if it's in your guidelines, which I haven't yet read, about the phenomenon of retweeting and the responsibility that, according to your doctrine, would then fall on the person who presses the button and forwards something on?
I was wondering, you said all of this started because of the telephone, and I want to know what the telephone's involvement in these new guidelines are. I mean, I'm thinking specifically about, if I can put it this way, the harassment many of us get from these calls that tell us that we have payment protection insurance, and we get those calls again and again and again and again, including on mobiles. Or the new one that started is somebody calling me to tell me that my computer has a horrible virus. And I say, how do you know that? And they say, well, your computer's talking to me. I said, oh, what kind of computer do I
have? Okay, thank you very much.
But I mean, this is harassment, and it's I want to know if these guidelines are affected by it, and if so, how can we get rid of these people?
Thank you. Libel, retweeting, and telephone harassment.
Yes, I'll take them in that order, if I may. Libel, strictly speaking, is obviously civil law, and therefore not affected by our guidelines. And as Lord McAlpine is demonstrating, libel applies to social media just as it applies elsewhere. Mm. As for the balance in libel cases between free speech and enforcing the civil law, that's obviously something for the civil courts to grapple with. There have been one or two judgments that have described quite well what social media is about and likened it to a sort of a notice board where things go up on a temporary basis. But that's the balance for the civil law. So far as the criminal law is concerned, we've tried to strike the balance in the way that I've indicated in the guidelines. There is still the question of where's the private space on social media where you really can talk to somebody else about what you really think, in the way that the Public Order Act protects your own living room. But broadly speaking, if you're in your own living room and you've got two chairs and you're talking to your pal, you can be pretty offensive, well, really, really offensive, actually, without breaking the criminal law. If you sat in the same two chairs and emailed each other or sent each other texts or Facebooked each other or sent a Twitter message, you know, if you were just communicating to the same person in the same room but using a public electronic communication system, you're caught by the O3 Act. Interesting unintended consequences of the history of all this. As for retweeting, I'm glad you raised that. The offence is sending the message by electronic communication system. You don't have to be the first sender. If you retweet, you're caught. When I first said this, people thought I was sort of being draconian and I'd introduce this new rule. The legislation makes the offence complete when you send the material, and there's no mens rea in the offence. So it doesn't matter whether you're the person who drafted it in the first place. And that's important for people to appreciate, because people do send on stuff. It also has raised this question, which we had to look at. In order to defeat very racist material on social media, some people deliberately retweet grossly racist stuff to draw attention to it so that people will do something about it. And where does that leave you with the criminal law? Because they've undoubtedly committed the offence under the 2003. And that just demonstrates to you that through no fault of Parliament, because it simply the timing didn't work, this was not constructed with the idea of social media in force. But it does create its own problems, you know, in terms of the movement of this stuff. Telephones are obviously still caught by the legislation, so the expansion of the offence into social media has not left behind telephones. They are still caught, so any grossly offensive message on a telephone is still caught. Again, the offence is made out when the call is made.
Roddy Porter, member of Chatham House. Could you comment on the likelihood of provisions such as these becoming in the future internationalised, i.e. somebody using social media in one country who is deemed prosecutable in another where treaties exist?
Hey, my name is Nimrod. I work for Vice magazine and make films for Russia Today channel. So I have 20,000 followers on Twitter, and like what can I tweet today that will get me arrested, for example, by the fourth category, which is then unclear? And what happens if, like, I write a tweet and my girlfriend, she clicks the share button? Like, she actually, or the entire family shares the same password for one account? Nobody knows who's tweeting, or my company, I mean.
Okay. On the international front, very, very interesting. There isn't any developed thinking or jurisprudence at the moment. I think there will have to be. Social media is not going to go away. There has been thinking about free speech in other contexts. There's going to have to be some discussion and hopefully some agreement about what the relevant international standards are. So that's limb one of international thinking. Limb two is, are there circumstances where we might seek to bring someone here for trial in England or Wales for something they've done elsewhere using social media? Anonymity is an interesting question. So far, it hasn't presented us with a huge problem, but it could do. And we'll have to cross that bridge when we get to it. And then, I'm not going to give you a form of words that you can send to constitute a criminal offence, although it'd make an interesting headline. But on the share button, the answer is whoever presses the button to send the message commits the offence if the content is sufficiently offensive to be caught by the Act. And that's quite interesting, because in the Daniel Thomas case, that's the footballer who tweets about Tom Daley, he did only send it to his followers. And it was one of his followers who actually got it out to everybody else and thus into the wider press. If you leave it ready to send, you don't commit the offence. But if you've sent it to your girlfriend or anybody else, you've already committed the offence if it's sufficiently offensive. Because you commit it by sending it just to one person.
My name is Mark Johnson from The Economist newspaper. To what extent should or could the communications networks themselves be held responsible for the messages that are sent over them?
Technically, there may be an argument for saying in some circumstances they are, but I think it's pretty unlikely, because if you look at the legislation, the offence is committed, let's say sending a false message, if your purpose is to annoy, distress, etc., etc. And so, although it's not expressed as classic mens rea, there is the sense that it's what's in the mind of the sender. And for that reason also, I think that it's pretty unlikely the service provider or other such company would be prosecuted under these offences. I'm not saying it's technically impossible, but I think it doesn't really sit with the spirit of the legislation.
Kieran Monks, Metro International. You mentioned the problems of scale, and given that Twitter tends to function in trends, would that not allow safety in numbers, because it would be very difficult to prosecute 1,000 people promoting the same message?
At the moment, the scale of cases that are coming to us is not such that resource is the primary driver for the guidance. But one always has to consider resources. when one's looking at an offence that's as broad as this possibly is. And if we're, you know, so 340 million tweets a day, you can put your own figure on the percentage you think might be grossly offensive. When you've done so, do the maths, and you'll see the potential for very many cases coming before the court. That is obviously a resource issue. It's actually much more important than that, because if there were tens of thousands of cases being prosecuted month on month for what people were saying, you'd soon get to the position where there are more prosecutions for speech than any other offence, and the chilling effect on free speech would be profound, which is why I've been inclined to the view that you should have a high threshold and you should steer away from prosecution, save in the rare cases where it's really necessary. That's not actually about resource. It's about whether people would have faith in a criminal justice system that spent most of its time chasing those that have said things rather than people that have done things. Yes, resources is always relevant. As it happens at the moment, it's manageable and it's not the primary driver.
Thank you so much. We'll all now go home, look at the guidelines and send in comments. But thank you so much for all of those interesting...
Not at all.